Missed it live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Andrew Woodburn is the MD of AMROP Woodburn Man. He's the CEO. He's the MD of AMROP Woodburn Man, talking to us about executive pay in particular. Now, this is a bugbear for me and all the boards that I sit on, where it's always about director pay and remuneration. We're talking about the determinant of executive compensation. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Kaya Biz.
Evening, reviewer, and to your listeners.
Likewise. Okay, so obviously all present company, and when I say present company, everybody who's been on the show excluded today. So we're not speaking about anyone who's necessarily been on the show, but keen to hear your perspective on the determinants of executive compensation. Nozizwe Vundla was just talking to us about the income and wealth disparities in this country. And of course, we know that South Africa has one of the highest multiples of executive pay to average or even lowest worker pay.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we're an emerging market and we all know our economic woes that we suffer from in terms of either underprivilege or ready to work, skills available, the legacy of our country and so on. But having said that, I wanted to start for you tonight for some of the listeners who probably either work piecework or contract work or hourly paid or those types of remuneration, remuneration being the word which talks about the rewards or pay that workers get. And of course, these CEOs and other senior individuals in very big businesses don't work on that framework, right? And in fact, if you think about it, let's just say Peter Engelbrecht, you know, hadn't in throughout all his stores, hadn't sold enough pies, for example. You know, Peter can't go down to the store and work an extra hour to sell more pies that are going to make a difference for ShopRite. So he is engaged. Let's talk about how he works for his company first, and then we'll talk about how he's rewarded. You know, he is engaged on a completely different style of employment, right, where his KPIs or key performance indicators are around specific performance measures that he and the company, represented by the board and a committee on the board called the Remuneration Committee. In other words, as you say, if you sit on boards, a group of people, he doesn't just negotiate with the chairman as his boss and they agree together. It's actually a lot more well-governed than that, around what his targets are, where the business is going, how they're going to measure those targets to see if he's achieving what they're setting for him or not. And so just in case you're a worker who, you know, just can't understand how people, CEOs, are getting paid millions and millions, right? Because if you're only getting paid a couple of hundred rand or you're getting paid a few thousand rand for sort of a contract or a week of work, you know, when you look at these numbers, they are way out there for our average South African in the street.
Just we don't have a lot of time, so I don't think we need to oversimplify quite like that. I think a large number of our listeners understand incentivization. Bonuses are similar, you know, then, you know, whether it be in financial services or whatever, whether it's multiples of the annual salary. These are numbers that are out of whack, not for the average South African on the street. They're out of whack even for a really successful trader in the stock market. And when you speak about the incentives that they have, I think the trouble that we have is that whenever we hear from Remco, or whenever we bring a dissenting opinion at a board level with that Remco, whether it be through our proxy votes and the like, the pushback that we get is that we wouldn't be able to get this level of CEO if we did not attract them with that particular salary that is internationally benchmarked. And then very often, same CEO doesn't actually meet those incentives or performance, whether it be share price, earnings growth, but still get big golden handshakes, very big goodbyes. Despite non-performance.
Well, of course, the golden handshake is a different thing.
Fair enough. Whether it's a mutual separation agreement, but we could speak about Ian Moore from Woolworths, for example, and the kind of pay that he sees. It's eye-watering that regardless of performance, get there.
You're right. Those kind of numbers are big. Once upon a time, there was an international executive. We'll talk about the past because then we won't get into any trouble. Who came to run Sasol and was earning 10 years ago 52 million rand a year, right? 10 years ago. And so that was a classic case of what we call an opportunity cost, a relative payment. In other words, why would he come here if he could do a different job for more money elsewhere? So that element is true. If you want to play in the global talent pool, you've got to remunerate at an equal level. But in many cases, if the CEO doesn't deliver on the targets, then they might get less of the reward. So they wouldn't get a super reward either for the year or the share that, because many CEOs reward, especially in their long-term bonuses, in other words, a rolling bonus that gets calculated often over a three-year process, the share price itself will go down and their reward is linked to that share price. Part of their reward might be linked to either a share award or an option scheme. And if that share price doesn't grow, they themselves won't get the reward. So while the numbers might be big, they absolutely are penalized for non-delivery and don't just get paid if their companies are in trouble or not achieving the agreed targets. They will get paid their basic salary, which,
sure,
like David Constable, it might still be 50 million rand a year, which to most of us, you know, even if you're a stockbroker and incredibly well off, I think 50 million a year is a significant departure from the norm in this country.
That's my point. I guess, you know, I want to speak a little bit in absolutes, particularly as when you kicked off, you spoke about us being an emerging market. Similar sized or mid-sized, but maybe further developed markets, for example, Scandinavian markets, where people live very well, earn extraordinarily well, also have to face the opportunity cost when they're hiring external or even internal executives, are very clear. It's legislated, I think, in Norway that, you know, the CEO cannot earn more than 30 times the average or the least paid employee in a company, which is, I think, why South Africa wants these disclosures to be made, because I think we're like in the top 10, somewhere around 180, maybe even more hundreds of times the lowest pay. And it's difficult in absolute to justify, even if you use different incentives, how a single human being's 24 hours can be priced at that amount.
Yeah. And the same might be put on the table in terms of looking at, for example, what a soccer player in the Premier League in the UK gets paid.
100%. Right? Except that viewership and advertising can actually be justified.
Yeah, there's no right answer to this. But I do think that your question alluding to transparency is the first step in awareness. There was a global mining house based in South Africa over 25 years ago that didn't want their multiplier to be over 50 times. And that was a self-imposed target for themselves. And, you know, so that was what we would call good corporate citizenship. But having said it, you know, if you look at, for example, some of the names we've talked about on the show, where they talk about 800 million rand in capex just to refurbish some stores, or, you know, the turnover of their business is over 100 billion. And I'm not even talking about global opportunity costs. Then, of course, you know, a lot of the investors, Nomination and Remco members, feel that you have to award the person who's responsible, which is fundamentally the CEO, at a reasonable level against the scale, importance of the business, against investors' funds, and so on. So there are often other reasons besides the global opportunity cost of talent. That means a good leader will be rewarded with significant amounts of money. And at the end of the day, you know, if we were just all going after tenders or playing soccer or singing music, you know, the question would have to then be, well, are we building an economy? How are we feeding the nation, i.e. through retailers or farming businesses? How do we get our minerals out of the ground? These are economic activities, and therefore the leaders of those businesses also need to be remunerated at a level that makes it both attractive to them to do that work, but also commensurately rewards them for the risk they take. So, for example, if we look at some of our mining businesses, you'll be familiar that now ESG, environmental, social, and governance elements are so much more prevalent in how investors look at businesses. But if something goes wrong with one of those elements, or in mining, we know safety has become, you know, has really been raised over 20 years around both work stopping injuries and even fatalities. then at the end of the day, the leadership of that business is now held accountable. And if it has all gone wrong, and it may not have been their cause, but they will still be held responsible for it. Those kind of events can terminate their career, for example. And therefore, you've got to remunerate them appropriately for not only the targets they're committing to, but the risk they take. And so it's complex to build, there's not one reason for why certain individuals are paid these big numbers. It's a conglomeration of a multiplicity of reasons.
100%. I'm so glad you raised mining and the risks as well as what they get paid for. So let's talk about Sibanye-Stillwater, possibly one of the worst performing mines, particularly between 22 and 23, I think, in terms of safety record.
Yeah.
Really great performer on the stock market, largely driven by the commodity price. But the stock option is linked to the share price, not the performance
of the CEO. Although
the
share price has been falling.
Hear me out about the 350 million rand check. So it's not the platinum price's performance is not due to the CEO's work. So there's a company that does well. So what am I being rewarded for? And then to your point about risks, I don't think Neil Froneman really faced the chopping block for those very difficult, dangerous conditions. You know what I'm saying? You know you can't just hire and fire a CEO like, for example, somebody who works at the till gets hired and fired.
Yeah. So let's talk about Sibanye as an example. I mean, I can't claim I know the technical details of his contract, but what I can say is that he might not be rewarded on entirely on, let's say, total top-line revenue of Sibanye, right? But one of the measures that they might be agreeing with him is his cost per ounce of production. Now, that is directly under his control.
For sure.
And if he gets that cost per ounce as a platinum producer down, then, of course, if the price goes up, they make super profits. But if the price is low, they still are viable, right? So the business can carry on. So there's a very interesting metric that the board might agree with him, that they want him to be producing platinum at a certain cost per ounce. And they may have a strategy that when the price goes up, they make super profits. And by the way, it's not only the executive that wins in that case. Let's go quickly to the shareholders so that anybody who's invested in that share, of course, gets big dividends and the share goes up. And in many cases, there are both empowerment deals and a share of wealth down into the workforce at different levels using different equations to get benefits.
Andrew, what happened?
That's an ideal scenario where everybody wins, right?
Correct. I'm not sure it fully exists. So, for example, let's say I make shareholders happy by not pushing through a wage increase. Let's say the share price runs because I pushed.
Which we know Neil was famous for his rock driller.
And I don't. I didn't want to go all the way there because it might get a bit dark. I'm just talking about. It can be in retail. It can be in cut costs. It's usually the labor force. And I would think, sorry that he's my case
example.
But it's just such a big pay, 350 million rand in a year. I can't avoid it. Now, I think 20 million rand in a year would be great, and I would love to see if 330 million rand could be shared amongst the people who actually pull the platinum out of the ground.
So,
I'm not trying to be a socialist. I'm just, I'm not embarrassed at that.
Let's add some facts to that case study. So I know for a fact that Neil actually spends a significant time of his year in the US. So his living costs and all of that is in dollars. If you take the 350 million rand and divide it by, on a good day, 17 rand 50, right? Suddenly it's not so big any longer as one element. Two, it's a global business. So it's not only about our rock drillers in South Africa. He's running now assets in the US which have dollar-based costs and so on. And so if you unpack it like that, it begins to fill in the context of that award, so to speak. But look, he's grown the asset base in Sibanye. We know, starting from some of the assets in Goldfields and then acquiring them. And if his contract with the board had been to grow the balance sheet or the market capitalization to a certain level, to run his production at a certain cost per ounce and so on, even if the share price went down, believe it or not, and he was hitting those other targets, there would still be a part of his reward due. But But just about every significant listed business will link probably what they call the long-term incentive of significant executives. It's not always the CEO only. Because they know it's the team.
No, even as
over
a junior
economist, rolling years to their share price, amongst other things. And the concept is that, you know, if the tide comes in and all boats rise on the incoming tide, i.e. the platinum price went up, as an example, then really you reward your leadership if your boat goes further up the beach than everybody else. Sure. And the part that a lot of us battle with is, of course, when the tide goes out, in other words, the price drops, there's a commodity slump, you know, the big industrializations are not buying, then you would still award your CEO if your boat goes out to sea less than others. And sure. So this corporate remuneration is a complex business. It's got many facets to it. There are experts in it who live a life only in corporate remuneration. And of course, many boards will say they want their CEO to be uniquely remunerated because that takes a unique strategy and converts it into unique tactics. And the CEO leads that, right? And therefore, that he should rise or she should rise or fall on both their success or their failure.
So, Andrew,
And you and I both know we've seen CEOs dismissed, you know. I mean, let's look at Nampac, for example. You know, the CEO of Nampac was dismissed and the business needed a turnaround and to be rescued, and it's currently undergoing that. But the previous CEO was fundamentally, his term was completed.
Yeah. Andrew, in order to get us back to the broader topic at hand, so thank you for allowing me and I suppose humoring me in terms of drilling down, because that's quite a tangible example. I wanted to pick up on what you said at the end there around many companies saying they want their executive to be uniquely remunerated. And maybe uniqueness is the point that I need to hone in on here. Is it really just about demand and supply? The fact that there's a limited supply of, let's call it, top 40 unicorns that could run a company, and that the rest of maybe particularly in a place with a glut of unemployment, we're just a little bit more expendable, and so the negotiating tables lean in the company's favor.
I think there is a strong element of supply and demand. I mean, I've trained as a development economist, and at this point we've got a big demand curve and limited supply. So in some ways, believe it or not, for all our workers out there and ambitious executives and senior managers, it is actually still a seller's market if you're good at what you do. And you are able to command a premium because you're in limited supply. So in South Africa at this point in time, I would say that executive remuneration reward is probably for difficult tasks in difficult economies, linked a little bit more to super reward for good results, because we don't have a lot of talent to deliver, right? But in other marketplaces where talent is saturated and there's a lot to choose from, and I work globally, you can absolutely see that the significant departures from that are way less. When people change jobs, they don't get a 10 or a 20% increase to change jobs. They don't even get really an inflationary increase of any significance. Like a lot of our workers in our country would get a 5 or 6% inflationary adjustment at the end of every year. I've dealt with businesses in Belgium and Luxembourg and so on, where inflation is basically flat and people haven't had their salaries adjusted for a decade. They're still working for the same money they were paid 10 years ago. And so it does, these nuances in getting rewards and the exact number you get paid are localized to supply and demand, to an inflationary environment, to the desire or the demand of the day, for example, like technology workers, data workers, system kind of thinking individuals, let's say, as compared with the pie seller behind the counter, right, where there might be more supply of people who could do that job. And so all of this comes into account. I'm actually for more transparency on the multiplier, because I think without that, no one does anything about it. And with it, we begin to raise the awareness. And I think you're going to see, based on good corporate governance, remuneration committees looking at that multiplier as a more important element to what they pay their CEO versus what the lowest earner earns. And that's a good thing for us.
Okay. All right, Andrew. I'd love to actually have this conversation a little bit more deeply in each of your topics going forward. We are out of time today, but thanks for allowing me a little bit of this pushback. I'm still in the copacetic times at the beginning of the lockdown when we realized that economies actually run with the essential workers and not the people in the offices. And it's just shocking to me how quickly we snap back to the old world.
I want to add to that because you spoke to Peter today. I know for a fact that the ShopRite executive, for all they paid, said that if their tellers and their shop and shelf fillers had to be at work, then they felt ShopRite was a significant service, a critical service 100%. To the nation. And that executive went to work themselves in their offices, and some of them got COVID and suffered for it. There is a great business where I want the people at home to know it wasn't that the high and mighty you get paid a lot sat at home. They got up in the morning and went to work like their tellers and shelf fillers did. And credit to them for being equal in how they delivered to the nation.
Thank you very much for making that point. Absolutely. That's why I was saying present company excluded.
But it's great to have a good example too.
Yes, exactly. I appreciate that you emphasize that for the listeners.
I appreciate the invite.
Okay.
And thank you very much to you and your listeners this evening.
Wonderful. Andrew Woodburn, MD of AMROP, Woodburn Man.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.